Heller McDonald, how do we get here? When you talk about the giants in the Second Amendment world when it comes to litigation and scholarship, David Hardy stands tall. He joins us right now.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Dave Hardy, attorney down in Tucson.
Sit down, please, and quiet, please.
For me, this is sort of a homecoming because I was born in Old St. Joseph's Hospital, about 10 miles from where we're sitting. It's a homecoming in a second sense because I was...
Hey, folks, it's hard to hear the speaker. Please quiet down.
It's a homecoming in a second sense because I was at the first Second Amendment Scholars Conference, which preceded the Gun Rights Policy Conference, back in 1977, I think it was. And those were gatherings of maybe 20 or 30 scholars, most of them not professors, who had published on the Second Amendment. We would get together to exchange ideas and often manuscripts that we were working on. How I got involved personally, well, in 1973, I was a writer for the Arizona Law Review. And law reviews are edited by the third-year class, editors chosen from among them, and the writers are in the second-year class. My editor, Mark Collins, told me that I'd written a piece on why gun control didn't work. And he said, that's a nice criminological issue, but this is a law review. You've got to have something legal in it. Why don't you do the Second Amendment? And I said, there's nothing there. That's something about states and the National Guard, which was, in fact, what everybody in the legal community would have told you in 1973. And he said, well, go out and do it anyway. So I went out and did it anyway and started finding, no, it's not about the National Guard. It's not about a militia. It's about an individual right. If you look back to the writings of the framers of the Constitution, of their contemporaries, the whole situation, you find, no, it had nothing to do with a militia, or very little to do with a militia. They wanted a guarantee of an individual right to bear arms. So I wrote up the law review, and the senior editors scrapped it. They tried to debate it with me, and they kept saying, this is specious, whatever in heck that means. It was sort of like, that's irrelevant back in the 1960s. You know, it was an all-purpose objection. And about 6 months ago, I was at a lawyer's party having a few drinks. I suppose that will shock you. And one of the editors from a year ahead of me was there and said, back in 1973, your position was too specious to publish. And today it's the law of the land. I said, back in those days, the mid-1970s, there were a handful of us writing on the Second Amendment. There was Joyce Malcolm, who was a professor, Steve Halbrook, Bob Dowlett, Richard Gardner, a handful of others. And myself, of course, we would circulate manuscripts around, get together at the annual scholars conference, exchange notes. But we were publishing in the small law reviews, Chicago, Kent, Northern Kentucky, Case Western. You got to understand, today there are about 500 or 600 law reviews. Back in those days, there were probably a couple of hundred. And they come out about 4 times a year. So if you're a big name in constitutional law, you're not reading every law review published in the entire country. You're probably focusing on the top 5, the top 10, maybe if you've got a lot of spare time, the top 20. Well, that concluded the first stage of the Second Amendment. We were all out there digging up the original historical material and publishing it. But it hadn't gotten to the top dogs in the field. That changed with Don Cates, the late Don Cates, unfortunately. He got an article in the Michigan Law Review in 1983. So this is 7 years into the process, maybe 9 years. Michigan Law Review, depending on who you want to believe, is either in the top 5 or the top 10 in the country. All the big-name constitutional law professors would be reading the Michigan Law Review. And it had an effect. Sanford Levinson, a well-respected professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas, read the article, was impressed, and published his article, The Embarrassing Second Amendment. I think it was in Yale Law Review, one of the really big-name law reviews. And his whole theme was that if we applied to the Second Amendment what we apply to every other constitutional amendment, we'd have to recognize it's an individual right, period. So that, in turn, had a chain reaction. William Van Alstine of Duke published an article, another very big name. Akhil Amar of Yale published an article or two and went on to publish about the 14th Amendment. Even Larry Tribe of Harvard, very liberal law prof, his first edition of his book on constitutional law basically wrote off the Second Amendment. His second edition acknowledged it was an individual right. The evidence was all there. Just said it was of uncertain dimensions, which of course is true. And there was one other effect of Don Cates' article, which was that a young law student named David Koppel was assigned to do the copy edit. And we all know what was the effect of that. He was quite impressed and decided he should get into the field as soon as he graduated the next year. We gradually started to specialize. Joyce Malcolm, whose background was in English history, would take on the English common law. Steve Halbrook moved into the 14th Amendment, which applies the Bill of Rights to the states and virtually established monopoly. I mean, if McDonald v. Chicago, if there were copyright laws applicable to the writing of Supreme Court opinions, the Supreme Court would be paying Steve Halbrook big royalties on that opinion. Anyway, by the end of the 1990s, we had the academic world pretty well locked up. This is, again, we're talking 10, 15 years of work. The academic field was solidly on our field, but the Brady campaign could still make its last remaining taunt, which was, okay, you got the law professors, you got the law reviews, but you don't have any court cases. Until the court cases start recognizing it, you're not in the real world, which is somewhat true. Then the third stage was taken over by an unusual team. Alan Gura, who has spoken at these conferences before, Clark Neely, and Robert Levy. They set out to bring the court case that would establish it, and they did a first-rate job. They picked the D.C. Circuit, which was one of the few circuits in the country that had never had a Second Amendment ruling. They picked the D.C. handgun ban, which was an absolute ban. So we're not getting into whether you can regulate this or regulate that. D.C. just banned handgun ownership. And they picked out some wonderful clients. Sorry. And also it was a federal jurisdiction, so you don't get into the 14th Amendment issues and all of that. Here's a law. It's a federal law. It's a federal jurisdiction. The Bill of Rights is directly applicable. They brought it, and I don't mind telling you that everyone was scared. One law dean told me, I see how you have two votes, meaning Scalia and Thomas. I don't see where you get to 5. They were so scared that NRA was pretty dang scared. And Brady campaign was pretty dang scared. Brady campaign tried to talk D.C. into repealing the law. That's how scared they were. So you got both sides scared of the outcome because you don't know who's got 5 votes, and that's the most critical thing. Well, they won 5-4. First they won 2-1 in the D.C. Circuit. So D.C. had to take the case to the Supreme Court since they lost. And D.C., excuse me, D.C. also was scared. Brady campaign was trying to talk them into don't take this appeal, but D.C. decided they were going to, and we all know the outcome, a 5-4 win. So over the period of, 20 years, it went from something that no law review would publish to a Supreme Court ruling. And you know, the first time I presented on this was in North Carolina, not far from the site of the Battle of Kings Mountain, 1783. The British are attempting their southern campaign, figuring they've lost out in the northeast, but they can maybe get the south conquered and split the country. Ferguson invented the rifle. He was sent to sweep inland among what they called the over-the-mountain men. And he sent word ahead that unless they dealt with it, unless they swore allegiance to the king, he would visit them with fire and sword, with slaughter and destruction of their houses. You didn't talk like that to the over-the-hill men, over-the-mountain men. They had some organized units, but for the most part, they simply decided that whoever this fellow Ferguson was, they were going to pay him a visit and teach him how to be polite. And so there was a tale of one of them who was sitting there casting bullets, and one of his friends said, what are you doing? And he said, going to shoot some redcoats. And the guy said, you're a Tory. You like the redcoats. And he said, still do, but they're getting too close. All the over-the-mountain men had ever asked was just leave us alone and we'll leave you alone. Well, they weren't being left alone. And so they started streaming toward Ferguson. And they didn't know anything about military organization except that there was a unit called the Company, which was about 60 or 100 men, and was commanded by a captain. So as soon as each unit got up to 60 or 100 men, they elected their best fighter as captain. I know I had an ancestor in Captain Sevier's company. They caught up with the British at Kings Mountain. They had no organization beyond this vague idea of companies, and they had about 10 or 12 of them, no higher command. They went up the hill, and in about an hour, Colonel Ferguson's command ceased to exist, completely annihilated, which led to the collapse of the Southern campaign. That's how it was back in the 1970s and 80s. We didn't have a command. We didn't have a structure. We didn't have any sponsoring organization. Each person fought on their own hook. It took a while, but in the end, we took that hill. Thank you.